This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The latest numbers from the Centers for Disease Control indicate that about 1 in 68 children has autism spectrum disorder. Now, some people are calling that an epidemic, but my guests today argue that the narrative is much more complicated, and it starts with looking at the term autism itself. It's a term that dates back to the 1930s when a pediatrician named Hans Asperger coined it to describe young boys who had high intelligence but limited social skills. Popular and scientific understanding of the disorder has evolved since then. The history of our understanding of autism is documented in the new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. The authors are going to be in Chapel Hill and Raleigh for events tomorrow, but first they join me for some conversation. John Donvan is an Emmy Award-winning correspondent for ABC and the moderator of the debate series Intelligence Squared. John, welcome to the State of Things. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be here.
Karen Zucker is a Peabody Award-winning television news journalist and the producer and co-writer of the six-part PBS series Autism Now. Karen, welcome to you.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. Let me start with you, Karen. Your journey into autism reporting started with the autism diagnosis of your own son. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, in 1996, my son was diagnosed with autism. At the time, I was a producer for ABC News, working with John Donvan on stories from civil rights to day of air economics. And the next thing I knew, I was a mother of a child with autism. And John and I decided we should start to tell the story of autism because it had not been told on network television almost anywhere.
How much of that story did you know before you had the diagnosis?
Very little. I remember being completely stunned by the diagnosis because my son had language, and I didn't know that children with autism could speak. That's how little I knew about it at the time.
You actually thought he was a bit of a genius.
Yeah, he was reading at 1.5, and he had what's called echolalia. So he had complete sentences, but they were memorized, and he'd walk around quoting things we'd say, and things like "I love you very much, but please don't touch the plugs," because we had been telling him not to touch the plugs. But we had no idea that that was any form of autism.
Well, John, tell us a bit about your personal connection with autism.
My wife grew up in Israel, and her brother, who's now in his late 40s, has autism. And he has autism where he cannot speak, and he's not somebody who, as an adult, has an independent life. But his mom, my mother-in-law, when he was diagnosed back in the late 1960s, his mom was told, as all mothers in that period were when their children were diagnosed with autism, you've got to put this child in an institution for the rest of his life. She took a look at the institution Israel was offering. She found it was a snake pit, and she said, "Am I going to do that?" And she and a few other families got together and founded an autism society there around 1971, and started building schools and started building residential communities and created a place in the world for her son and for other people with autism. Which interestingly motivates and parallels the story that we tell in a different key, which is very much. For the first 60 or 70 years, is the story of families really doing everything they could against some unbelievable odds that we didn't even know about, the things they were up against until we started researching. They started to push back and to create a place in the world for their kids in this country. In fact, a lot of the important stuff happened in North Carolina.
Well, I'm going to talk more about that later, but I do want to get to some of the deep history of this, a history that begins before we even had a name for it. It begins in the mid-19th century, John. Tell us more about that.
Well, I want to say, Frank, first, any diagnosis that of a person we can't meet has to be speculative. Really, 100% we're saying we don't know for sure whether people had autism 100 years ago, 150 years ago. But there are cases that are really intriguing where you think, listen, what little I know about such and such an individual, if that person were here today and was diagnosed, it looks likely that that person would be a candidate for autism. And one of the cases that we found was several cases, in fact, come out of Massachusetts in 1846 when an educator and physician named Samuel Howe became very concerned about the plight of intellectually disabled people in Massachusetts. And he got money from the state legislature to take a survey of all of the people in the state who fit that description according to paper letters they sent out to town clerks, who in your town, the term they used in those days has idiocy. And he got back a list, and he and two other guys got on horses and spent 2 years riding around, surveying the conditions of that all of these individuals lived in. Some of them were terrible. Most of them were terrible. And then he came up with like a database that he created, very modern in its way. He took measurements and took medical histories of all of these people. Well, here's the interesting thing is that he said, I can't fit a number of these people under the label of idiocy or intellectual disability. I can't, they don't fit. There's something about them where they're too gifted. They have too many skills. They're great with math. They're great with music. They have perfect pitch. All kinds of, one of them, Karen just mentioned her son had echolalia, repeating things over and over. There was a 56-year-old man he described named Billy, who could do everything around the farm that he lived on. He could milk the cows. But if you said to him, Billy, go milk the cows, instead of going to milk the cows, he would stand there and say, Billy, go milk the cows, over and over and over again for hours. That's echolalia. And it occurred to us that what we were seeing in that old report were very, very vivid descriptions of probable autism. Again, people who, if we could see them today, we think very likely would get the diagnosis of autism. So, you know, it's our view that autism has always been with us in to one degree or another.
Well, and the story of autism is really the story of connecting those kind of dots, isn't it, Karen? And when we talk about when the term finally gets a name in the 1930s, again, this is a matter of people sort of connecting the dots. Tell us that story and the story of Hans Asperger.
Well, our story really starts with Leo Kanner, Dr. Leo Kanner, mm-hmm. and the first person diagnosed with autism. At the same time, Hans Asperger was doing research on children with personalities that were very similar to the children that Dr. Kanner was seeing. And we tell the story of the first person ever diagnosed, and he was known as Donald T. And he is the person who is our story throughout our entire book, and it helps thread the story of autism because he was the first person ever diagnosed, and we grow old with him.
Donald T. I'm sorry, Frank. Because in the medical literature, when Leo Kanner really was the first person to write in English about autism, and actually. Asperger used the adjective autistic, but right. he didn't call it an autism. It was Kanner who first called it an autism in the modern sense of the word. And he described this boy, Donald, and only gave his last name as T, as his first case. And as Karen says, we've had the great luck of being able to find Donald T and spend a lot of time with him. Karen actually is the one who managed to track him down, which is kind of a very telling story in itself.
Well, I do want you to tell that story because, in fact, the entire story, the history of autism, is threaded with, in fact, populated by stories, and this is the tie that binds. So do tell us, Karen, the remarkable story of finding Donald T.
Well, John and I were in the middle of doing our research, and we know from Dr. Kanner's papers that the first case one, was Donald T, as he was named, and we learned that he was from Forest, Mississippi. And so we had enough information to go on to start to try to find if there was a Donald T in Forest, Mississippi. And it was 2007, and I did what anybody would do looking for somebody in 2007, is I opened the phone book, and I started to call all of the people whose last names began with the letter T. And I thought it would take months, but actually about a dozen names through, I reached a phone where an answering machine picked up. And all of a sudden I heard this voice say, "Hello, happy spring, and have a wonderful fall, and a terrific December. Happy 2007. And I have a child with autism. I heard this voice. I knew exactly what was going on. This was Donald. This is a person who had autism. I called up John. I said, we found him. We know who he is. Now we got to figure out how we can speak with him. And we were not going to just go and knock on his door because that's not the type of journalist we are. And so we sought out his family and friends. And we were very, very, very interested in seeing the reaction that everybody had to us wanting to meet Donald.
Because when we showed up there and said to friends of the family and then to members of the family, we'd like to meet Donald. Would you introduce us? People really looked us over hard. We're both from the Northeast, and they see these two Yankees coming to Mississippi. And they said, one guy literally said, I'm a redneck. And if you hurt Donald in any way, I know where to find you, and I will find you. But I'll introduce you. I'm going to trust you.
And we heard that three times.
Yeah.
They weren't kidding. But what was really fascinating is that was the first inkling we had of this way this community had embraced this person his entire life. And John and I talk about it in the book, and we hope for it in the future, which is if you see the town of Forest, Mississippi, and the people that Donald grew up with, the way that he was embraced, if we could bottle that and put that all over the country, that level of acceptance and caring and protection for someone who was different, we could really change things.
I do think that's one of the most telling parts of the story, that first of all, the detective case and the detective work of finding Donald Triplett, but also what you just said, the fact that so much of the therapy could be around communities embracing, whole communities coming around, mm-hmm. People with. So we're going to talk more about that, about treatment, a little bit more about diagnosis, and a lot of the myths that have surrounded autism throughout its history. When my conversation with Karen Zucker and John Donvan continues, they are the co-authors of the new book, A Different Key, The Story of Autism. They're going to be at the Autism Society of North Carolina in Raleigh tomorrow at 11:30, Chapel Hill Public Library tomorrow night at 6:30. We've got that information on our website, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking today about the new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. The book traces the history of the syndrome since before we had a name for it, and it tells the stories of people on the front lines of the advocacy movement and the many families and individuals affected by the disorder. I'm joined by co-authors John Donvan and Karen Zucker. They're journalists. They've been reporting about autism for more than a decade. And before the break, we were talking about Donald Triplett, the first child in history to be diagnosed with autism. But let's talk about how our understanding has changed, because particularly the causes of autism. Karen, tell us about the refrigerator mother theory.
Well, the refrigerator mother theory is one of the darker times in the history of autism. We actually tell the stories of women who experienced that, and in it. In a nutshell, the description of refrigerator mother is that the mothers did not love their children enough, and that's why their children had autism. And it's a heartbreaking time because these parents and mothers were doing everything they could to help their children who were struggling to live in the world and were being put into institutions. And we tell this one story about this woman, Rita, who... What they would do once your child was diagnosed is they didn't want to treat or figure out how to help the child with autism. They wanted to psychoanalyze the mother because the mother was the cause of the autism. So Rita, at this point in time, has found out that her son was diagnosed with autism, and she is talking to a therapist. And she, like every other mother, is doing everything they can to try to figure out what did they do wrong to cause their child's autism. Because if they can figure it out, then they can solve the problem. Then their child won't have autism anymore. So all of the mothers totally have bought into this because that is what society is telling them. It is their fault. They need to fix it. So if they can figure it out, then maybe their child won't have autism anymore. And Rita was trying to figure out for weeks and weeks, as she's seeing this therapist soon after her son was diagnosed, you know, what is it that I did? What could I have done to make my child have autism? And all of a sudden she remembers, you know, when he was first born, she was expecting this beautiful pink and rosy child. And instead, her son, who had jaundice, so he was yellow, and his hair was sticking up. And she remembers her very first impression of him was, oh my gosh, he looks like a chicken. And then she thought that day, that's it. I thought my child looked like a chicken. And that must have been, from that moment on, what I had done to cause his autism.
And this just, it broke our hearts to hear this, because she was telling this story 35 years later. She knew that that theory was now dead, because it was popular in the 60s primarily, a little bit into the 70s. But even when she told us the story, she still had some sense of, I wonder if I did do something after all, because the layers of shame that mothers were burdened with in this period, where they were told by every authority, every doctor, every book in the library about autism, told the mothers that they had caused autism in their children. And for Rita to tell us this story now, she's in her 70s and she's She's got a good life. Karen was the one who spent the time with her.
It was the first time she ever told the story.
Right, right. And she just cried through. This older woman cried through the memory.
Right, and as you suggest, still carried lingering guilt, even though she knew better because of the trauma of that entire period, which brings us to the question of how this disorder had been studied, and certainly before all of the genetic advances that we have enjoyed in the last decade or so, or a couple of decades, whether or not this is studied as strictly a behavioral disorder or a genetic disorder. Talk about the history of the way we've researched autism.
It's been done differently in different places. And one of the interesting things we found is that different cultures even process autism in different ways. Karen made a trip out to South Africa and followed around some autism activists there who were going out into the less educated parts of the country and trying to convince families there that their children were not possessed by demons, which was what a lot of the people there believe is what autism is really about, and they were treating them with spiritual ceremonies and sometimes exorcisms. And in France to this day, there are still psychiatrists who are advocating the refrigerator mother theory, so they think they know the answer still, that mothers cause autism. In this country and in the United Kingdom, which is the two countries where autism really gained traction as a conception, in the United States, at least from the 1970s to the 1990s, it was looked at as something that could be treated through behavioral methods. And that's where most of the effort was put on, particularly research done at UCLA, some of which in itself was very, very harsh and brutal. In the early experiments, they were trying to see if they could suppress children's tendency to hurt themselves, because a lot of children with autism of the more severe variants, not only are they unable to communicate with words, but they bang their heads and damage themselves. And there's not sort of an opportunity to reason with them in the typical way. And so behaviorists were trying to find methods to get the kids to stop hurting themselves. And in the early days, they used electric shock on the kids to make them do that. And the sort of tragic thing about it is it worked. So the kids did stop for a time. And so there was a great big battle fought here about, do you use electric shock on kids who are damaging themselves, hurting themselves? Ultimately, it was through a lot of lawsuits, political action, a stop was put to using electric shock, but more positive methods were developed using behavioral methods to encourage kids, number one, not only to not hurt themselves, but to begin to use language and to connect in more typical ways with the world around them. And to this day, most school systems rely on these positive behavioral methods. But the other thing you asked about genetics and sort of biomedical research period, Karen wrote the part of the book about the efforts, again, of parents to create an interest in that, because as of 1993 or so, nobody in the physical biological sciences had any interest in studying autism whatsoever. It was seen as a total dead end, and there was no funding for it.
There was no scientists researching autism. And part of that was the offshoot of the psychiatric world saying it was the mothers that caused it. And there was Dr. Bernard Rimlin who actually fought back on that and broke that hold on the fact that mothers caused autism. And in the 90s, there were two parent groups that formed almost simultaneously, and both of them deciding we need to figure out, what causes autism, what kind of treatments there can be, and they literally created a field of scientists in the autism world that never existed before.
And the way they did that was with money. One of these parents, his name is Eric London, lives in New Jersey. He's a psychiatrist, actually, and has a son with autism. He started going to conferences of neuroscientists and mingling among them during their sort of social breaks and saying, have you ever considered studying? I'm talking about, this is 1994, 1995. Mm-hmm. Have you ever considered studying autism? And they all shook their heads like, what, why? Where's the money? Where is there a career path for me as a scientist? And so he came away realizing that there was zero interest in the biomedical field in trying to understand autism sort of from the inside out, from inside the brain or any other biological system. And so he and his wife and another family out in California, actually for a time they competed with each other, they started to raise funds and going back to these conferences and saying, have you ever considered studying autism? No, there's no money in it. Well, here's money. And they began to
give grants.
To give grants to young. What they did was they went to younger scientists who were just getting their doctorates and saying, we will give you a career. We will fund a career for you in scientific research into autism if you will commit to it for X number of years. And they began getting proposals from all over the world. And it's from this root, these seeds, that today's enormous scientific interest in the biomedics and genetics of autism comes from. It's only 20 years old, and it comes from this parent activism. Now it's got a life of its own.
Interestingly enough,
I was just going to say,
even though it might have been more difficult to get this thing jump-started in the 90s, what medical research there was highly controversial and has since been debunked, not necessarily debunked, but proved not true, and that is the connection between vaccines and autism, and that got going in the 1990s, too. Tell us more about that and its impact.
Well, our take on the book is that at the time that the question was first raised, which was in 1998 in London, and then that idea really became contagious on our side of the ocean as well. The idea that kids were getting more vaccines than ever before, which is true, and that there were more reported cases of autism than before, which is also true, that those two things somehow went together in a causal way, that the increase in vaccination dosages and frequency was causing more apparent autism. The problem, and at the time it was asked, as we say in the book, it was a reasonable question to be asked. Of course, you see that correlation? Let's examine it. So it was examined, and it was put to rest. Study after study from an epidemiological level looked at the trends, not just in this country, but in other countries, and it just turned out not to be true. That's not to say that the idea didn't hold on in a lot of places and still does to this day, but in our book, we take the point of view of what science tells us. We believe in science.
How much do you think the tenacity of this? Well, go ahead, Karen.
I was going to say, what's interesting is if you look through the history of autism and you see in our book, the stories that have changed the world are all stories that parent advocates have done in terms of closing institutions, in terms of opening schools for children, and we chronologize the passage of time through stories throughout the entire book.
Are you there? Karen?
Yeah, we're sorry. Karen just had a thing go down her throat.
I'm sorry.
And needs to get a little bit of water.
One of the things I want to talk about, too, is the fact that the tenacity of the argument and the belief, the heartfelt belief among some, and the fact that this has hung on, the connection between vaccines and autism, which has since been scientifically proved not to be linked. How much do you think that has to do with the power of the refrigerator mother narrative, which is, I mean, if you're to blame for this, wouldn't you love it if you could find something else to hang this on and something as concrete as vaccine? And so to what extent do you think those two might be linked, the tenacity of the myth and the power of the refrigerator mother narrative?
Well, I think it's about hope. And which is somewhat of what you're saying, but it's more in your soul that if you have the hope that you can fix your child, if there's something that you can do to cure them, if there is any kind of hope that it's not just something that's out there that you can't do anything about, that you're driven to believe in it. And that means if vaccines just like parents, I guess. If that's the cause, then maybe you can fix it.
Yeah, and it's a really great question, Frank, because the autism community is very unique, you know, relative to, say, organizations that exist around other developmental disorders, say epilepsy or intellectual disability. The autism community is very, very highly motivated, always contentious. It's always been torn up by inner tensions and people arguing with each other. And some of it is, I think, is what you were just talking about, and also Karen saying that there's hope. There's always been this vision with autism that I can do something about this to change my child's fate and outcome in life. And because autism itself is such a really badly defined condition, it's not nailed down as something that you can test with a with a biological marker. There's no cheek swab to say autism, and there's no DNA test to say autism. It's all based on two things: observing somebody's behaviors and then deciding what behaviors actually add up to autism. And that second part, what behaviors add up to autism, has changed again and again and again. It's autism has gotten bigger and it's gotten smaller. It's been very narrow. Nowadays it's called the spectrum. That may still change. And because of that, as we say in a different key, it gives the opportunity for anybody to sort of claim almost anything about autism. And it's happened. People have said autism is a behavioral problem. They've said it's a vaccine problem. They've said it's a mother-causing problem. They've said the solution is vitamins. They've said the solution is psychoanalysis. They've said the solution is behavioral therapy. And we think it goes back to the actual vagueness of the definition itself that allows for all of these many people just sort of pile on to the topic of autism.
Well, that's not Jen, to say you that mentioned, there's not something. You mentioned that North Carolina played an important role in the story over the past few decades. Tell us the story about the North Carolina Autism Program, TEACH.
The bottom line is that in the 1970s and 1980s, North Carolina was the place to be if you had a child with autism. People were moving to the state to get access to the superior services that were offered in North Carolina through Program TEACH. And Program TEACH grew out of Chapel Hill, a program started by a guy named Eric Schoppler, who passed away in 2006, and Bob Reichler, who still practices psychiatry out in the Northwest. And they started a program where, in important ways, they pushed back against the mother-blaming theory. They began to work with kids, creating a program of structured education that included the parents. Schoppler was the hero to the parents because he said that parents aren't causing autism. Parents are part of the solution of helping their kids with autism. And so successful was this program from the point of view of bringing parents in, bringing kids in, kids seeing and great progress being made and being able to acquire some language, being able to gain some independence. Not everybody, because everybody with autism is different, but there was nothing else like it at the time. And in 1971, the funding was going to run out for this program. And the parents got together, and I've spent a lot of time in Chapel Hill interviewing these parents who are now in their 70s and 80s. They were amazing people. There's a mom named Betty Lou Warren, known as Bobo Warren, and Betty Camp. And with no political experience, they got legislation passed that set up this program called TEACH, which put education for children with autism all across the state of North Carolina, which is why people were coming to North Carolina. They had a day in 1971 when the legislation was in the balance. They got a church across the street from the State House to convince them to use their basement to cook breakfast for all of the legislators in the State House. And they put out word to all the legislators, oh, the place is going to be packed with media. And they put out word to the media, oh, the place is going to be packed with legislators. And both sides bought it, and they both showed up, and a presentation was made about the need to help these kids. And it worked. The legislation passed, and to this day, TEACH is in place. It's been enormously influential, not just in North Carolina, but across the United States. There are TEACH programs all around the world, particularly in the United Kingdom. And that comes back to parents, these two mothers, mostly, and there were other parents, but they're the stars of the group, doing everything they could to try to figure out how to make the system work for their kids.
Well, and Karen, in the epilogue of the book, you talk about maybe where some of the activism should point today, those with autism, those who have autism as they age and aren't children anymore. Tell us a bit about this.
Well, Frank, we tell this story at the end of the book, which even though we there isn't a cure and we don't know what treatments will really help all of these children, there is something that we can do as a society. And we tell the story that happened on a bus one day in New Jersey.
Yeah, there's a young man riding on a bus in New Jersey in 2006. He's sitting in a front seat by himself. He has autism. He's not verbal. But he starts making some loud noises, and he starts rocking in his seat and flipping his fingers in front of his face. That's called stimming. And two guys sitting behind him get very annoyed by this, and they lean into him, and they start to harass him. And they say, hey, man, you know, what's your problem? What's going on with you?
And all of a sudden, this other guy stands up, this other passenger in the bus stands up and says, hey, he's got autism. What's your problem? Why don't you back off? And all of a sudden, the whole bus gets behind him and this young man with autism. And the bully is the odd man out. And that's what we see as the future, the immediate future that we can do something about it, that if we embrace and we protect and we stand up for those that can't protect themselves.
And adults need this kind of support because, as we say in the book, they don't have the cuteness factor anymore. And what we want to, the reason we wrote the book, really, is for everybody else on the bus. I mean, this is a book that we think will appeal to the autism community because it's their story. But it's really a bigger story. It's about everybody else on the bus to let them know, first of all, there's this really wild, kind of unbelievable story about autism that we didn't know when we started, but that we all have a role in it. We're all the people on that bus, and we need to stand up for the people who
and
are
we can
different.
Do it. It's not hard to do.
And well, it's been really gratifying. I mean, a lot of the comments we're getting are from people who knew nothing about autism before say, this is an amazing story. We had no idea. And they do kind of get that they are those people on the bus.
Well, thank you for sharing so much of it with us. John Donvan and Karen Zucker are the co-authors of the new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. John and Karen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks, Frank.
They're going to be talking about their book at the Autism Society of North Carolina in Raleigh tomorrow at 11:30, and then they're going to be at the Chapel Hill Public Library tomorrow night at 6:30. And, of course, we have those details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to look at the intersection of music and politics on Broadway in the 1930s. Stay with us.